Everybody, welcome to the show. I'm your host, Mike, and welcome to Amateur World Tours. Thanks for joining us this week, and we're continuing our journey through the decades with Jay Skipworth. Jay, welcome back, man. It's always a pleasure, you know, as this whole journey has always been a pleasure, but I'm really excited to, you know, keep the journey going and, you know, tack another movie off our list. And so, yeah, how's everything been going, man?
Man, Mike's been going good. Always good to catch up with you and talk. And, you know, we're now into the 90s here, and one that escaped me somehow in the 90s, though it was definitely in my wheelhouse. So we'll talk about maybe why I didn't see this when it came around. And then, I don't know, man, I hope you got your books of knowledge around, because I got questions. So, you know, but yeah, familiar territory, though, for the director, because we've already done one of his films and we talked a good bit about it the last time. But yeah, interesting to get back into Terry Gilliam's sphere here on Amateur Tours.
Yeah, and we don't need to retread, you know, Gilliam and our relationship with him, but what I do want to focus in on is this specific movie and how you haven't seen it up to, you know, this point. You know, it's because this seems like more one of his more mainstream movies that was more critically accepted. And I mean, it seems like there's always drama on the sets of Terry Gilliam, but this seemed to be the one that had the least amount of noise while it was being made. And then it was received pretty well by everyone. So this is like the one that was, you know, that everyone should like, but you missed it. So, you know, tell me about that.
So 1995, let me take you back, Mike, 1995, where I was in life, I was in college. And at that point in my life, man, movies had kind of taken a back seat in terms of creative outlet for me. And I was in a prime about 6-7 years where I was so focused on music and writing songs and playing in bands and just really trying to learn how to be an actual guitar player and, you know, doing all that stuff there were so many movies that just kind of came and went that I missed on. You know, I love to tell the story about probably the most famous movie, maybe from 1995, The Usual Suspects. I had no idea that was even a thing. And then a guy that I lived in the dorms with, a little bit older than me, I worked in the campus paper with, and he did some music stuff with me. He was like, dude, trust me, you need to see this thing. So I ended up renting it like that summer afterward, you know, and watching it. And just, my thoughts on that are well documented over on a old episode of Filmstrip. But in 1995, again, I saw very few things in a theater. And, you know, it was like for a few years there, man, I just wasn't watching movies that much. I would watch the things that, you know, I either owned on VHS at that time, or if I caught something on, you know, cable or whatever. But most of my time was spent doing music and stuff. And so I remember a lot of my friends talking about 12 Monkeys, though, and just, you know, all over it. And I thought, okay, I'm going to get around to seeing that. And then years go by and whatever. And then I said, you know, I need to finally knock that one off the list. And then, I don't know, man, I started the podcast. And when, you know how it is when you do a podcast, it's hard to watch anything that's not part of the show at some point. I think at one point I had 3 shows going. So it just fell down the list. And then it became kind of a, oh, you know, maybe I'll finally get around to that when they made a TV show out of it. And I tried to watch a little bit of the television show, but it really wasn't my speed. And I clearly didn't know what was going on. And so, it was on my short list. And then as we started putting things together, it was one of the early ones we identified, like, yeah, that's probably the one to check off from the 90s finally after all this time, long before we even had Brazil on the list. I think this one has been on there for a bit. But that's how I missed it, man. I didn't see it because I was doing other stuff at the time, and then I don't know, just didn't get around to it again. And then when we started talking about doing this, I said, well, I don't want to blow it, you know, so I just held on to it for a little while till we got around to talking about it. But I mean, 95, I was a big Bruce Willis fan at that point, and I'd seen Madeline Stowe and stuff. I didn't really care about Brad Pitt, but and still don't, honestly. He just doesn't really do anything for me, but I don't think he's for me, you know, in a theater. But I don't know, it's just kind of a weird thing. And I do remember people talking about this, though, going like, this is not Die Hard, Bruce, this is a different Bruce, you know. And I think that's a true statement.
Yeah, and you know, I'll say it too. So I was born in 1995. So you know, we'll just throw that out there as well. But I don't really remember when I had first seen 12 Monkeys. It had to have been high school, and I must have been just like stumbling it around. You know, when I first, you know, high school was really when I started getting into movies more superficially. I feel like it's really since graduating college that I've really started like analyzing film on a different perspective. Even because we started amateur all tours when Brian and I were sophomores in college, and I don't even really think I started getting my own like voice until like post graduation and doing conversations like this. But I just always have memories of watching 12 Monkeys. I guess that goes into the theme of a kind of like lost in time and like what is and what's not reality. It must have been in high school and must have been when I was on like a Brad Pitt kick, like right after watching Fight Club for the first time, and just like, oh, let's just see, and like, Pulp Fiction, like, oh, Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt, let's see what's going on. So it's always a movie that I revisit like once every like year and a half or so, just because it's so stylistically interesting. I mean, as I and then I found out that's just Gilliam's style and like who he works with and brings on to his films. So this was my first introduction to Terry Gilliam. Well, I guess knowingly, because I had watched Monty Python growing up, and I that's just a that's a group of individuals, an ensemble of writers. So this was, I guess, my first true introduction to Terry Gilliam. But before we get into this film, I was going to ask if you had seen the short film that this is based on, the 1960s French like new wave a science fiction feature.
No, I did go and look it up on the dark side of the internet after watching this to catch a little bit of it, but I realized very quickly that sometimes I can watch a foreign film and I don't need the language to, pull me in or whatever, but I was so very lost and just couldn't go there. But I did pick up on a few things, but I also realized that unlike some short films that become the adaptation for something bigger, down the line, that it's really just the morsel that's the central theme, and this got put through the Gilliam ringer, when he began to do it. But what I think is interesting about this is real quick, because visually and stylistically, there's definitely a look to this movie. It's got this whole like steampunk aesthetic and stuff. But I also feel like it's of all the Gilliam stuff I've seen, it seems to be somewhat restrained a little bit. Like it's definitely living in a box that normally he doesn't tell stories in, which I thought was interesting. And I put a lot of the credit on that to Roger Pratt, the cinematographer who's worked with him for years and clearly knew how to shoot this and make it look like the time period. The 90s is known for a lot of things in film, but sort of used future realism and just how unclean anything could look is a common theme you'll find in a lot of films, particularly thrillers and dramas and stuff where they don't overly glamorize the way the city looks. Like think of a movie like Heat, I mean, that's shot all around LA and some of it, yeah, it sure looks good, but it just looks like a town where people live. This is a city, and so I appreciated that about this, unlike Brazil, which was kind of fantastical anyway, but in some ways took me out of the movie sometimes. This one I never really got lost in that.
And what I will say about the short film, it is a French New Wave film, and it's entirely made of still photography shots, which I think, I love abstract, like experimental films like that. So I dig it for its style. You have some really very unique, compositions that are being made is shot entirely in black and white. But it's this idea of a man who is witnessing his death, and like this idea of like manifest destiny and, predeterminism. And there's like a lot of heavy themes that I feel like Gilliam is picking at here and cherry picking. So we kind of loosely follow the story and the narrative of the short. A man who was a prisoner in the aftermath of, some post-apocalyptic whatever, and he is being sent back by the survivors to try and just gather data and then bring it back. And so they don't change history, but they can just, fix their situation as they are in that moment. So that's like the basis of it. I do recommend watching the film for anyone listening. It's only like 28, 30 minutes. You can probably just find it on YouTube. That's how I found it, or like Vimeo or wherever. It's probably streaming somewhere. And it is, I think, worth the look, just as more of like if you're a completionist, I think it is like a unique perspective. But jumping into 12 Monkeys, yeah, you do have the interesting point of like it does feel of all of his films very restrained and very like it feels like someone is like there's ideas where it feels like he's about to go off the deep end, but then it just feels like someone's like no, we're gonna rein you back. And I think it works the film very, very well. It doesn't feel like someone is cutting his artistic vision down. It feels like someone saying, hey dude, maybe Maybe we shouldn't do that. Maybe we should do it, maybe go this way. And it's more of like a guiding hand as opposed to this like authoritarian, nope, you cannot do it. Because we all know what happens when Gilliam is faced with the authoritarian its hand of the studio. You know, he fights back to mixed success.
Yeah, and that's what's funny about this is it's Atlas Entertainment, you know, is the production company. Universal distributed it, but they weren't in there giving any notes and stuff. So it's clearly his own head and maybe just years of hearing it from others. And I think also when you're working with the group of actors that he's assembled here for this, and it's kind of known, you know, Bruce Willis will tell you what he thinks. Like if you're shooting it the wrong way or he doesn't like it, he'll let you know. Pitt at that point. Well, didn't have the kind of clout that he has now. It was just starting to come into that. You know, this was something he did to kind of break out of the quote pretty boy image that he had, you know, to do something different. And then, of course, Madeline Stowe just been around a long time and was a really gifted performer, but she had Christopher Plummer kind of bouncing in and out of there, really for small pieces. So I give a lot of this actually to Willis because by all accounts, he had a really good relationship with Gilliam, even if at times when they would kind of get on each other a little bit, but it was really just to push each other. And the thing about Bruce Willis, man, is, and I don't think people appreciate this about his career, there's a lot of times he's been asked to carry the narrative of a film that's really hard to explain. You know, sometimes he's doing the simple stuff. Die Hard's pretty simple, you know, but you do something like this and The Fifth Element and some of the other things he's done. I mean, it's not easy to live that. And he's a man that has to live multiple versions of himself throughout different points in time, you know, and that's just a hard thing to do. It's like playing four characters at once. And, you know, in spite of my overall thoughts of the film or whatever, I really do get why people associate Bruce Willis and this being one of his like seminal performances and stuff because he really does give a heck of a performance here, even when I don't know if the story completely serves him, he's doing a lot of work in this movie.
Yeah, and this is, you know, the era before, you know, he stopped like really caring about acting, and you know that also now, you know, with that we know today, you know, I think he has been diagnosed with dementia, so
Yeah,
I think a lot of
yeah.
that also factors into it. But it was, you know, kept a secret for a while. But you know, in the early 2000s, well, I won't say early 2000s because like late 90s, early 2000s, because we still have like you know, Sixth Sense kind of era, but. You know, I always think of Bruce Willis kind of modern day, you know, you see the montages of him just like, oh yeah. Like he's just like ad-libbing, doesn't know the lines. You know, I think of him on, you know, his little stint on Broadway where he did Misery, and all the reviews were the set design's great. The woman that plays, I think her name's Annie or
Annie
Anne,
Wilkes,
yeah,
yeah.
Annie Wilkes, you know, she's fantastic, she's phenomenal, but he is awful.
Yeah,
Like he
I
is
think
atrocious.
every actor at some point or another, whether they come from stage or not, or they have any, they want to try that. You want to do the prestige Broadway, you know, the big play and or musical or something like that. And you know, a lot of them come from that anyway, but I think for other actors, it's just like this white whale to chase. Like being able to, you know, it's one thing to be able to act in front of a camera when you know there's going to be a cut, there's going to be an edit, there's multiple takes. You do that, but you know, play, man, like you really got to get it right, you know.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty heady story too. There's a lot of dialogue. It's really two people the whole time. And I've heard the same thing that went famously bad for
Yeah,
him,
he had
but
an earpiece and he didn't know his lines, and he was
yeah.
trying, he's playing it almost like John McClane, as I hear.
Yeah, which
And
is
people are
not what
like,
that character is at all. The
and
way he's
people are
written
like,
it.
well, at
Yeah.
least we'll get our money seeing John McClane, you know, on stage. But
Yeah.
here we're not getting that. We are getting the exact opposite of John McClane. You know, we
No.
are getting a very dramatic role, from really, and I feel obviously the standouts in my mind are, you know, Bruce Willis and Brad Pitt. So generally, before we kind of get into like the nitty gritty, like general thoughts of 12 Monkeys here.
I mean, the thing that I like about it is that at the center core of all of this is this environmentalist, anti-corporate point of view, but it's also like these people have a point, but they're going about it the wrong way. You know, it's like having a message, but delivering it wrong. You know, and I think Gilliam is having a bit of fun with that of like, yeah, eco-terrorist, that sounds like a good idea till you actually do it. And then you realize you're part of the same problem, you know, and what if one of them, to prove a point, set loose this deadly virus that his dad's, you know, company may or may not have created, you know, all that. What if that happened? And it's one of those fun little like Reddit rabbit holes that you can go down, you know, you start having a little fun with that. I think that's fun. And at its core, again, there's something really interesting about that and the way that that works. But I think the other thing here too, and this is what gets me, and it's kind of contemporary because we're recording this around the time that Oppenheimer's in theaters. And, you know, I haven't seen that movie yet as a recording, but it's not like I didn't know the story. I mean, we all know that, right? And having read a lot about it, the theme of that is that if given enough time and resources, we will find unique and interesting ways to destroy ourselves. And that, I mean, at its core, that's what 12 Monkeys is about. Though I feel like all the time travel stuff and all the grandfather paradoxes and all the, you know, the things that are sort of the peripheral parts of the story have become the thing everybody latches onto. And I think it's what the TV show wanted to lean into a lot more, at least from the few episodes I watched. And I think that lost the message, because I think the message is pretty simple. And beneath all the twisting turns of this is that destruction is inevitable. It's how you choose the form of how it's going to come. And you know, you've either got the corporate greed that's going to run us all into the ground, or you got the people that are going to be so anti that, that they do something brash and ridiculous themselves. And either way, it has dire consequences. And I don't know, I found all of that to be really compelling when I watched it, even if I didn't catch all of it. And I'll be honest, Mike, I had to watch this thing three times you know, to really feel like I got it. So I, you know, and I, even still, I still don't know that I got all of it, but that was kind of my overall like thesis from all of this was all of that points that I just laid out there, that it's all about the inevitability of self-destruction for humankind.
Yeah, and that's literally the opening text of the movie is like in 1996 a deadly virus is released and billions of people will die and the survivors will retreat underground. Like that's the opening mm-hmm. of the movie. It's not, you know, we don't get this like sexy shot of Bruce Willis. Like, you know, we don't get the Terminator sequence of them mm-hmm. coming to the future, which is, you know, when we talk about the time travel, that's what I appreciate most about how time travel is handled in this movie, where it's not mm-hmm. the focus. It's about the inevitability of us destroying each other. And that's, you know, the more, you know, depressive mindset of, you know, a bleak mindset of humanity is that, you know, the inevitability that we will just kill each other. Mm-hmm. Or like that pessimistic viewpoint. But I, you know, that is the opening of this movie is a text that says everyone is going to die by our own hands. And then we get into like our opening theme. And, you know, the opening credits, but really I love the theme of this movie. It really, you know, that accordion motif and it really just emanates with like, you know, the monkeys like kaleidoscoping around. It really has that it's reminding me of, you know, the street performance, probably going back to like, you know, Paris of like the dancing monkey with the accordion.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like circus music. Is what I took it as, you know, it's the whole monkeys theme again. And it's, there's something just slightly off kilter about it, you know, and I picked up an accordion or two in my day to try to figure out what to do with it. And I couldn't really make it work, but I had a couple friends that could play and it was neat to watch sort of just, you have to have all these different sets of dexterity and rhythm to know when to hit what when and to get that kind of funky sound out of it and when to push, when to pull and all that. I mean, it's very it's complicated. It's more complicated than it sounds, but yet it gives some of the simplest, just I don't know, eeriness. There's a way to do eerie music in a movie, and it, like, you hear The Exorcist tubular bells, right, and you just automatically are in like a space, right? Well, this sets you into like, oh, this might be kind of fun, you know? And then you realize like, oh, everything has gone to hell three times and they're sending somebody back in time and they don't even send him to the right year, but they actually did send him to the year they wanted to because it's all part of the corporate, you know, all that stuff. When you realize all that, it makes the music so much more, I don't know, like enlightening. Like I found it to be kind of neat that they lean into it that way, and that what Paul Buckmaster's doing is setting you on this kind of circus this whole time, because this whole movie is a big circus anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then like with that the circus motif with the caged monkey, you know, we cut to we get the dream sequence of like kind of setting up that early mystery, but then I'm more interested excuse me in the post-apocalyptic future where everything is that this feels more like Gilliam's world of like this dystopian crazy camera angles. It's dirty. You know, we this is where he still kind of throws those digs at, corporate authoritarians. They're essentially, our prisoners are Bruce Willis, they're like animals in cages. And there's this whole motif of just, animals in cages, releasing them, with the eco terrorists in here. And Bruce Willis gets pulled for volunteer duty. He's voluntold to go do something. And then we kind of, again, establishing this post-apocalyptic world. Philadelphia, my neck of the woods. I'm more in the suburbs, but because I didn't recognize any of, I recognize like some of the sites, but I'm sure, Brian, he actually lives in like Center City, Philadelphia. I'm sure he'd be like, oh, that's Market and Spruce Street on this corner. And I'm like, that does definitely look like Philadelphia to me. But yeah, I love these establishing shots and sequences of this post-apocalyptic world.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a good use of, I think they shot around Baltimore, Maryland, some too, to get more of it, because the water in Maryland's cleaner than the one running through Philadelphia. Real shock. And
That's
so,
saying something too.
yeah, it really is, especially in the 90s. But no, I think weather wise too, it just worked out a little better. It was a tough shoot by all accounts. But what I found neat about this man is how they, the scientists are offering this, Bruce Willis's character's name's Cole, James Cole, this chance to do this, but he's constantly like having these dreams of things. And I wanted to ask you, is the Cole that we see who's constantly being sent back and forth in time, are his dreams a result of previous time travel and they're like lingering memories and stuff? Because I kind of think they are, because some of the stuff comes through, but not all of it does. So it's the same way of like if you have a nightmare that's somewhat reminiscent of a place you've actually been, but you don't know where to place it. I don't know. I've got this cool like deja vu whole thing going on, and I wondered what you thought of that.
It's really interesting because I love how they tackle time travel when they don't explain it. And I always like this might seem a little obscure, but in the third Austin Powers movie, before they send him back in time, and he's like, "Wait, but if I do this and that, blah blah blah," he's like, "Oh, my brain's imploded." And Basil Exposition just looks. He's like, "You know what? Just go along for the ride, enjoy it." And he breaks the fourth wall and says, "And that goes for you too." And then Austin Powers turns and says, "Yes, enjoy the ride." Like that's kind of how I feel like time travel should be handled. It's just a narrative device. You can take movies like Primer or Looper and be like, "Well, technically this one," it's like, no, time travel doesn't exist. So I love how they use time travel here as a narrative device. But I like what you're saying, and I agree with you. I think Cole has been just being sent back repeatedly, and I think that he's having memory issues. And it's so much so I love this idea because I'm actually writing my own. I play D&D. I'm a big nerd, and I'm writing a homebrew. All from my imagination. That's gonna. And my buddies don't listen to this, so it won't matter. That I'm writing up with time travel as like the central like narrative device, and we're going to be visiting different historical time m components. And one of the key themes that I thought of, but am ex watching films like this, is the idea of memory is being corrupted, and they kind of get it in Inception as well, where it's with this idea of dreams that you'll start to lose your touch on reality. And Cole, from the beginning, is losing touch with reality. I think that they've just are continuously Volin telling him that he is going to be time traveling, and because of that, his memory is all. He has no sense of reality. He's always perpetually in the state of, I have no idea where I am.
Well, and I got this sense too that, and I agree with you, it's smart to use that as a like framing device without over explaining it because it doesn't really matter. It's the MacGuffin. It's just how we get from here to there. It's the train you take. It's the DeLorean, whatever. We just do it. But I love how like, I mean, the first time we see Madeline Stowe, she's given this lecture about, mental patients that get stuck in this, I think she calls it the Cassandra complex, which I learned about that not from literature class but from Scream 2. But this idea of someone who's constantly seeing this bleak future or whatever, and everything, I mean, that is Cole's life, is everything is bleak and messed up and it's never right, and no matter what he does, it's never going to be right. And the more he comes to grips with that, and realizes that there are no good or there's no good on either side of this. So he has the one agency of I'm going to choose the ending that I want so that I don't keep getting caught in this loop. I don't get back in time. And I mean, I know that's kind of how the end works out a lot, and it takes us a while to get there. But I was really fascinated with this idea that this was unhinging this guy who probably was pretty normal to begin with. And maybe that's why they picked him out of everybody in the asylum, everybody that they had their hands on in the hospital, that they had access to. He was the one with the most like intact brain to start with, you know, whereas like the Brad Pitt's character, he was always a little off somewhere. So when you send somebody like that through time, it just screws him up even more. It's like you re-scramble the already scrambled egg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And the other point that I mentioned a little earlier about the use of time travel is that the scientists of the future, or the present, or whatever, wherever, you know, we're just as we're also lost, and our brains are being scrambled talking about the time. But the scientists that send Cole back, they're not interested in changing the future or the past. They are interested in preserving their own asses and, you know, restarting humanity. But to do that, they need data collection. And they're always, you know, that's what we're seeing when he goes out into, you know, the Philadelphia ruins, is he is collecting data for them to study.
Yeah.
And he shows that he is, you know, of ample, he's sound of mind and physically fit, that they can send him back and he can get things done. Mm-hmm. And I really do like that perspective of time travel, where it's, you know, because, you know, the trope is you go back and you have to change history. And, you know, whatever the causality loop, you know, we're not interested in that. We just change it. You know, we're here to change the future, mm-hmm. or change the past to change the future. But here they're like, no, just gather data, let us know, you know, leave it on this voicemail when you get back, and, you know, we'll take it from there. And they have some really interesting playoffs with that as well. And I do really like how I do love the framing of this too, you know, it feels like it's like residual sets from Brazil, you know, when they like, oh, take a seat, Mr. Cole, and they strap him and the chair rises and we have these floating orbs around. Definitely feels residual, like the future from Brazil.
Yeah. Very 1984 too, is very much the mm-hmm. world that Orwell thought the world he dreamed up that he thought would become.
Yeah.
Super automated, a lot of tech, AI kind of running everything, which sounds eerily weird to say in 2023, but I mean, yeah, it's very visionary in that aspect. And what I find neat about this is that they keep sending him back, you know, to try to get him to commit to the mission, because they're sending him on a goose chase to derail the army of the 12 monkeys, the eco-terrorists. So what he learns and what we learn along the way is that their big protest was just locking people in cages and letting the animals loose at the zoo. But they got blamed for dropping the plague when the plague came from the lab and all that stuff. And I thought, I mean, there's just something like real weird about that, Mike. I mean, you work in the medical field. I'm sure you've kept it with, you know, things with the pandemic closer than most folks and things. But there's something very just, again, you can kind of get in your own little Reddit rabbit hole about like, man, they're always going to blame it on somebody that's different, but it's always the man that's really behind all of it. And so what you realize is that they're not sending him back so much to gather data to change everything, it's to make sure they are not the ones blamed for all mm-hmm. of this, which is, on one hand, it's like, God, that seems like an elaborate thing to do. And on the other hand, I'm like, that's exactly the kind of thing the multi-billion-dollar corporation would do to yep. make sure that it was somebody else that got fingered for it.
Because even from the beginning, you know, I never really bought, like when Bruce Willis or Cole goes out and he sees, you know, the army of the 12 monkeys, we did it. I'm like, I don't buy it. You know, that just seems like it's the red herring. You know, I never really thought that the army, I knew they were involved in some capacity, but I was like, I don't think that they actually released a virus and said, we did it. You know, I think there's something a lot more sinister going on in the background. And it's interesting because I never really even took it that the scientists, I always took it that the scientists were sending him back to ensure that history plays out the way it's supposed to. Because they have a panel of biologists and psychologists, and they d and going with the theory that his brain is scrambled and he has no idea like where he is on this timeline. They definitely have interviews of him, and they picked him, I think, specifically because they knew that he didn't know where he was, and that he would ensure that they didn't die in the apocalypse.
Right.
It's
Well, not
almost,
only,
yeah, it's ensuring their survival.
not only that too, but again, I think there is the larger purpose too, to make sure that no one can ever blame them for it. Like if you know what the future is going to be and you want to keep it that way because it's obviously advantageous for you that it works out that way. Well, one thing people crave is a scapegoat and an answer, right? Like our society's built around that, right? There's tons of literature and all kinds of pop culture built around that, and every mystery is sort of built around the idea of figuring out who done it, right? So if you control time and space enough to be able to ensure that those things happen the way they're supposed to, you're darn sure going to make sure that the narrative gets told the way you want. And what I liked about that was it was a bit of a twist off of what Gilliam had already explored a little bit in Brazil, where I thought maybe that kind of lost its way somewhere through it because it just got to be so ridiculous. Is that in this case, even though it is kind of fantastical and it's strange, is that because you've got such an everyman in Bruce Willis and the Cole character, that as he learns the truth, he also realizes I can't do anything about it. But it's just letting the audience know, just so you know, this is how this works out. And these are the people who are the culprits. And, for somebody like Gilliam and in his generation in particular, they revolted and rebelled against the norm and everything because they didn't feel like they could ever change any of it. And in the process of doing that, they altered culture forever. But if you ask any of them, they were just making a joke. Like they had no, they didn't know. Like they were like, we were just the scapegoats where we didn't know what to do. And I think in a lot of ways, he's playing with that motif here in the middle of this, again, this big sci-fi, thriller story.
Yeah, exactly. And I love when we finally get to the past, our what would be the audience, the viewing audience in 1996, the present for them. I love the, or I guess we go back to 1990 first. I love the decontamination scene between the institution is the exact same in the framing as it is in the future. And I'm like, oh, I love that motif of like, yeah, nothing's really changing. And I think it really reinforces that idea. Is like, is he, well, because they kind of play with like, you are a schizophrenic and you like none of this is actually happening, which I never really bought. But I always took that more as just a, it's further having Cole question his sanity later in the film. But I love those motifs of just like, he's being scrubbed down with absolutely zero humanity in the exact like shot composition's the exact same, and then we just kind of throw him into this insane asylum because the solution to the problem, and kind of still is today, where you have a dude on the street saying, we're gonna die by this eco-terrorist, 7 billion people are gonna die, Dave, oh yeah, just go away into the, and I even think Brad Pitt says that. He's like, they lock us up in here because they don't want us contaminating the population. But I just love this whole sequence. And this I and again, I love Brad Pitt here. He you could it and it doesn't obviously he's trying to, get away from that pretty boy, that idea, like that Hollywood star, like I guess now would be like the Disney star. Not that he was that, but it's just this like idealistic version of that. And this is, he even, I think he put contacts in that would give him a lazy eye. So he like even deliberately tried to make himself look ugly,
Yeah, he went through all kinds of, they said like he made people in the set like hide his cigarettes from him so he'd start tweaking out all the time, and just wig. And I think the Goins character, the Jeffrey Goins character, is such a neat one because we want to make him to blame for a lot of this again, that he's this radical unhinged thing or whatever. But with the twist of it, when it comes around and what he tells Cole is like, no, you're the one that actually released the virus, and I told you about it. I told you that it was at my dad's lab, but you're the one that did it. And you did it because they sent you back to do it to make sure it worked. Like when that is revealed ultimately, and again, it took me three times to catch that, Mike, I was like, oh. So he is just as much this controllable agent of chaos as Cole is by these scientists. And so you realize that they're throwing him back too to make sure he intervenes in whatever timeline they've got James Cole in at the right moment to make sure it all still works out the same way. That's what's twisted about it. And the problem in this, and my biggest problem with this is the Rayleigh character that Madeline Stowe plays, man, she is wasted in so much of this. She is just there to kind of be the damsel, sometimes in distress, sometimes not, to do some exposition dumps that aren't necessary. I don't know, for the plot, I kind of feel bad. And then the way that they end this thing with her like looking at the boy and stuff, I was having this whole like weird moment where that woman in Big realizes that like she, you know, hooked up with a 12-year-old after Tom Hanks becomes a kid again, you know, like that. There's a lot of that going on. I was like, this movie is not about that. I don't know why they tried to stick that in there at the end, but I feel like she kind of got wasted in this, and I've seen her in good stuff, so that bummed me out a little bit, because I want her to have a little bit more to play in this, except to just be the literal driver sometimes.
It's interesting because she is a really strong character introduction. We introduce her, you know, she's at the art gallery, and you know, they're going on this like really this long-winded, you know, this is what this art piece is, and I honestly can't remember that monologue. However, you know, we get immediately, her beeper goes off, and she, you know, it's a black tie, black dress kind of event. She leaves to go to work, and she's actually, you know, she's introduced as the strong female character. You know, she's not taken seriously by the panel of psychologists because she's a woman, which is interesting because after this movie, you know, I saw the opposite of Oppenheimer. I saw Barbie. So that's like a whole, you know, whole take on, you know, modern feminism and the road that feminism is going on. So I thought that was really interesting that, you know, she was introduced, you know, in the mid-90s as this, you know, what we thought would be a strong female character, but it's a damn shame because the movie goes on, she just runs out of things to do other than just like progressing the plot and this exposition dump and, you know, and then, you know, just going with it. It's kind of a little uneven and goes all over the place, but at least we have a strong introduction in the beginning. And I think it's interesting that the only person that genuinely cares about Cole is this woman, this like motherly figure. She's the only one that's actually willing to talk to him, which I love when she introduced like, oh, we doped him up with like six horse tranquilizers or enough tranquilizers to kill a horse. And Bruce Willis is huddling with a tarp on, drooling profusely. And I'm like, oh, that's, and she's not afraid of him. She goes up and shows that humanity.
Yeah, she does, and she gets to do that. But again, I feel like a lot of times she's just there to be set dressing, and that was my complaint about it, was that they could have done a lot more with that character. I would have even liked it more if she was one of the scientists behind like the dark screen or something, you know, along the way. Like if she was there as like the active guiding part of it, man. Maybe that's too tight, and it wasn't what they wanted to do with this movie. But I would have liked it more. The thing about this, you know, doing these through the decades, and the thing that we've kind of always noticed is, what is this saying about the time period it's made in, right? And the 1990s, you were born during them, so let me remind you of your childhood.
Yeah, I was born 2 months before this movie was, or 3 months before this movie was released.
The 1990s were known as a time of decent prosperity, but they were known as a time when we had to manufacture enemies for ourselves because the Cold War was over, quote unquote. You know, we weren't in an active conflict at all times, you know, and we had all this advancement coming in technology that was changing our lives. I mean, you talk about like the beepers in this. I remember when that was a big friggin' deal, man, if you had a beeper, and now like it's a garage door opener, right? You know, I mean, we carry beepers now. Nobody talks on your phone. You text on it, right? But it's the same idea. And I remember thinking like, oh gosh, all this technology is going to change our lives forever. And it was. And cinema at the time kind of reflected either we're just going to ignore all that and just tell the story, or we're going to lean into it and it's going to be part of the story. And in this movie, they use it as part of it. And the thing that came out of all of that, which was the neat thing about being a Gen Xer and growing up in that time and kind of coming to adulthood in that time, is that much like the late boomers before us, which is where Gilliam's generation is, we were incredibly distrustful of everything and kind of still are in a lot of ways. And it's because it wasn't because we thought we knew better or could do better. It's because we all believed in this nihilistic point of view that it doesn't matter anyway, because we're all going to wind up in the same spot. And to see that played out in a piece of cinema like this is neat to come back to, you know, all these years later, 28 years later, as it were, to try and unravel, like, is this indicative of really what my generation thought of the world and the way it was going to go? And we were all consumed with, everything was so peaceful all the time, Mike. We all knew, like, well, we're just one, you know, thing away. We're one Chernobyl away from it, just the whole thing just coming down, you know, because the House of Cards is real. And as it turned out, you know, shortly after the 90s, we saw how, you know, everything was very loosely pulled together. And I don't know. I feel like when you watch a movie like this and you take it into its context of its time, even though it's a futuristic movie or whatever, it's very much indicative of that mid to late 90s cynicism that really predominated everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so I feel like the most interesting part of the movie is about to happen, where, you know, he, you know, Cole gets sent back. He says, "Oh, you sent me back to the wrong time." Well, did they? But, you know, first viewing, you're kind of led like, oh, you know, and you could kind of look at it as like the ineptitude of like the authoritarians of, you know, oh, like the machine is just as broken as these people. You know, this is why the society is failing, because the machine is broken. But, you know, upon more watching, he's like, well, is it, you know, did they actually send him to the wrong time? But we get this idea of, you know, they send him back and he gets sent to World War I, and then he gets shot in the leg, then gets sent to 1996. And I love this World War I like brief segment, because it's just so jarring. You're like, whoa, like, where did this come from? And I mean, it's there to also, I feel like this sequence was there to really squash the idea that this is all in his head, because now we have evidence of that. And I kind of think that that's a little too on the nose. I like the ambiguity of it, because later on, I just feel like that whole sequence of, you know, questioning his mental stability, which it already is, you know, loose as is, but, you know, this idea that's like, oh, it's all in your head, you're just a schizophrenic, I never bought that. I don't know if anyone in the audience, and who was the millions, billions of people who've seen this movie, if anyone thought for one second that this wasn't actually happening. I do like the sequence of, you know, them sending him back, and then, you know, he gets shot, and then he gets sent back to 1990s, well, the time he's supposed to be sent to, which I guess there is a little bit of that ineptitude. But again, you know, when you look at the larger picture, you know, that World War One image and bullet, you know, reinforced to Riley, like, oh, like, this convinces her to follow this dude to the literal end of the earth.
Yeah, no, and I mean, that... At first, I always thought that whole World War One thing, I'm like, what's the point of that or whatever? And what you realize is that that's really Riley's test, you know, to get her back on board. It really has nothing to do with Cole. And I was pretty blown away by that. I thought that was cool. And was a smart way to get that character involved in a story where she's, again, peripheral to a lot of it, you know. And ultimately doesn't, you know, really can't change anything about any of it. But I don't know. I thought this movie at times is a little too smart for its own good, but in a lot of ways though, it's just perfectly smart enough. Like it just gives you enough to keep you involved the whole time. Cause the thing about a movie like this is the more they keep, you know, pushing you in and out and back and forth in the timeline and stuff, can get like whiplash at some point. You're just like, oh, I was worn out from this. And this one knows when to bring you back to square one, to center again, and push the story forward without, you know, losing you too much in, if I'm making sense.
Yeah, no, it makes perfect sense. Perfect sense. So yeah, now we kind of get more of like the meat of the narrative, I think. Like everything has kind of been set up, and now we're actually now we're in the time we're supposed to be at. We're in, you know, the year that the virus is released, you know, Christmas time of 1996, which is when this movie was released. I'm actually looking at
I know
the release
what a
date of
twisted Christmas movie, right?
Yeah, of
this and
December.
Heat are in the theaters at the same time in December, and I'm like, man, that's a weird pairing.
Yeah, you know, it's a movie actively telling people. Oh, so this was released 95. So, you know, next year, this time, you'll most likely be dead. You know, that's a really interesting way to open up your movies. Say, yeah, you're gonna die next year. I mean, you know, it's not like a 2012 situation where it's like, oh yeah, like, good luck, everybody. But this is yeah, that is interesting. But yeah, so we're in the year that the virus is released. You know, it's around that time. And I do really think it's an interesting how well we have the book signing of Riley in Baltimore. This is when, you know, we're talking about that Cassandra complex and you know the doomsday you know these doomsday alarmists or apocalypse al alarmists, and you know we're actually introduced to our real villain, which. And you know they have a back and forth with Riley, and then she gets kidnapped outside in her car, and you know it's a very scary moment, and then she recognizes that it's oh it's James Cole, like wait how did you escape? Which that we didn't even talk about the quote unquote escape, which is also expertly shot. You know we don't linger on it. You know we have him you know briefly on that we have him. Head down to a shot facing down. He's strapped to it in like the white coat room, which I've seen a few of those. They haven't changed very much in the last 20 years, in psych wards. And then they're like, he's gone. Where the fuck did he go? And they look up and they see the vent and like, you mean to tell me that a heavily sedated, restrained psychiatric patient escaped and climbed through that vent 15 feet in the air, and then we hard cut, which I think is that dark humor of Gilliam that we never get. Like that's the punchline. We don't need the answer to it. It's like, yep, that's, and I guess the answer would be, yep, that's the only other logical explanation. Like he escaped, or like how else did he get out of here? So we get to 1996, and we actually, you know, on this car ride up to Philadelphia, it's like surprisingly heartwarming. I actually really love this. This is probably one of my favorite, like, singular acting moments of Bruce Willis, at least in this movie, when he's listening to the radio and he's like, wait, I love this song. I love this. And he's like smiling and he's just a little kid again, you know. He's like that child that will witness his own death. You know, he's rolling the windows down. He's like, I love this. The air is so clean here. I love it here. You know, I love the radio. And I'm sure, you know, Riley's like, you think this is clean air? But as we all are thinking, but you know, it really
Yeah, but to
reinforces that.
him,
Yeah.
it is, you
Yeah, he
know,
doesn't have to
and
go out in a hazmat suit and get
yeah.
decontaminated when he goes outside. And I just love this little moment between the two of them where Bruce Willis is just like, oh, hold on this. I love this song.
It's only the one of the only times I can remember in a time travel movie where they actually admit to something that is the biggest problem with time travel besides the physics of it, is what gives you to think that you would survive in a time before your body and your biochemistry was immune to things and doing things. Like particularly, like I think if we went back in time, you probably do better off, because more likely than not, we've all been, you know, vaxxed from, you know, lots of things or whatever. But there are also diseases that don't really permeate in our society anymore that we don't, you know, do anything for. If you went back too far, man, you wouldn't know how to handle. And it's the same as like if you went and brought Abraham Lincoln to modern day, he'd probably die of a cold in a day, because he would have no idea like what was going on. And we fed him one meal and he would probably keel over from everything that was in it. So I mean, but that's kind of the, I mean, that's something that this movie is playing a little bit with, is that, you know, it's a 40-year window or a 30-year window that they're playing with for the most part. And I almost wonder too if that's one of the reasons they didn't linger long in World War I, because like, oh man, we got to get this guy out of there. He's going to die of all kinds of infection
Yeah,
in
he's
his
gonna get
fridge.
mustard gas in his lungs. We can't
Yeah,
fix that.
or no telling what kind of, you know, infection he's going to get in that gunshot wound to get him back forward here. I don't know. I like that. I thought it was neat. It's a neat way to play with that idea, because again, if the whole thing is about a deadly virus that kills everybody, well, they're still constrained by that in some ways too, because there's only so far they can move this guy around for him to healthily function. And that's also probably one of the reasons he's deteriorating as much as he is, because he's going back and forth so much. It takes so much out of you, you know? And I don't know, I appreciated that about it. I thought it was a smart thing to do.
Yeah, exactly. And there's the other themes that we kind of get at in the World War II or World War I theme that it's hinted at and it's kind of stated is that they're sending people all over the place. And that's like there's also the horror of that. We see, I think it's Jose, that he is also sent back into World War I. He's like, hey man, hey, what's going on? I see, he's almost a little too relaxed that he's in this like hellscape of World War One. And then but with that small idea, it's like, well, how many people have they sent back to ensure that, like, is Cole the final piece, or is he just a cog that they just have to keep sending back to ensure that they A don't get blamed and that A and B that they survive
Well,
this pandemic?
the thing I like about that is that these stories usually do come down to like it's one person on one mission to do it. And what you realize is that there's never one person that does anything by themselves. There's always supporting people. And maybe Gilliam's making a little bit of a fun thing that people talk about, I have movies or, Terry Gilliam films, but it's really a collaboration of like a lot of people that you don't even know that make this the way they are. You're everything from the gaffer, here working and the DP you've never met and the best boy who sets up the lights, all this kind of stuff, the people you never think about that make this work. And I got to thinking about it too, just from like a good conspiracy point of view, right? Because I like going down that rabbit hole sometimes. It's fun. I don't think any of them are ever real, but it's kind of fun to think about, right? And what it would take to pull something like that off, the number of people you have to have involved, it's a little bit like the setup to Ocean's 11, where they talk about what it would take to rob a casino and like the 12 things you have to have going on at the same time to make it work. And I'm like, it's the same thing here. You got to have this woman that believes in him that's got the access. And you got to have the guy that's going to make sure that either gives him the gun or makes sure he points the gun at the right time that goes through his orders. And you got to have the crazy loon, quote unquote, that's his object of affection and point of view and trying to figure out what his deal is. We've got to give him all these things and we keep this around. So what I like about that is that you realize that they're not just sending Cole back, they're sending all these people around. It's like a gaggle of folks going back, and that's what makes it fun. It's the same thing they tried to do in that Terminator Genesis movie, but just completely failed at it on almost every level. Now that movie's a dumb popcorn fun, but it is not good, like from a narrative standpoint at all. And it's because they don't know how to make this kind of thing work in it, whereas 12 Monkeys does.
And that's almost, I mean, I never watched a TV show. I know I only really knew about it because Brian Quinn from Impractical Jokers, he had like a little bit in a scene, and I was listening to one of his podcasts and he talked about it, and I'm like, oh, let me just go watch the scene. He's actually like pretty good in that scene, and it's like very dramatic for him. And then as I was looking it up, I saw that I think the other Jokers make like jokey appearances in it, and I'm like, oh no, I'm not really interested. Like it just, and like the scenes were purely comedic, and I'm like, oh, like I don't really have any interest in seeing this because the juxtaposition of those two scenes, where this is like very dramatic, like almost reminiscent of like something like Mr. Robot, like serious writing, like stylistic cuts, this like very like bleak dialogue, and then we cut to Sal, Murr, and Joe like messing around and pushing each other. I'm like, yeah, that seems kind of like a weird pose, but it almost seems like the show should be about like almost like an anthology where it's like each episode is someone they send back. And hey, Netflix, if you're listening, Jay and I can help write some of those episodes, but
Definitely could have, but no, I think you're onto it though, that's how this thing works, and it's what makes I do think it's what makes it last and has given it such a, I mean, you can see why they would want to turn this into a television show, right? It's such a rich tapestry. I mean, the fact that they jam all this in to the little over 2 hour runtime that this is pretty impressive. Nowadays they make this movie, man, it would have been like 250, right? It would have so much bloat to it that you wouldn't be able to handle it maybe. This on the other hand, like I don't know, I thought it earned the runtime. Like at no time was I bored with it at all. But I gotta ask you something, man. Like the end of this, and it's been debated all over the internet, so I'm just want to get your point of it here. Does Cole go through with the death by cop aside because he sees his younger self and he knows he's going to live on and this loop will go? Because I don't know. I kind of wonder if he's that sentient about all of it.
I never took it as like he made that her like that sacrifice of like, because I feel like it would have been a little bit more bleak and or at least a little bit more self-aware, where it's like, I have to do this. Like, this is just how it always, like it, I never had that moment of clarity or that like epiphany of like, oh, like I can't fight fate, so therefore I'm just gonna keep going. I always took it as, you know, it's in the airport, because he's going, they decide to go to the Florida Keys, and I never really understood why the Florida Keys. I mean, don't get me wrong, I've done scuba diving down there, the Keys are awesome, but in the con, I guess because it's warm and it's bright and it's sunny, because the whole movie is just like grays and it's cold and it's, you know, it's always overcast, you know, it's always the magic hour, and you know, the Florida Keys are not that. So maybe that's kind of the idea, where it's just not the Northeast in the winter, because it sucks up here in the winter. But I know, yeah, I always took it as like, you know, once he has that call from Jose, or when he sees Jose in the airport, he's like, wait, this is still gonna happen? Wait, there's Dr. Peter, or the character's name, Dr. Peter. He's like, wait a minute, that's the guy. And I love that sequence too, where he's like, what is this? You know, he's like, oh, it's, you know, it's harmless. You know, yeah, you can open it up, you can breathe it yourself. And then and the guy, and he's like, well, you open it first. And then Dr. Peters is like, you know, patient zero, opens it, inhales it, and says, yeah, see, it's safe, you can go and you can inhale it. And you know, at in Philadelphia Airport, which I'm going to be going to tomorrow, that was ground zero for this 12 monkeys pandemic. But I never, it was in that moment when he sees the doomsday, you know, person, you know, the person that just releases everything, I took it as he's like, this is my responsibility to end this. And then it's not until afterwards he realizes, oh, this is everything that my life has been building to this moment. Like, literally, life has come full circle. And that's where we get the idea of like fate, predeterminism, like, can you fight fate? Which I feel like is a common theme in these time travel movies and stories, is it inevitably comes up as fate and predeterminism, and like you can't really fight your fate. Even if you change something, like if you go back and kill Hitler, someone will just take his place. If you go back and you killed whoever, or you ensure that something doesn't happen, you know, I think it's you know, it's a ripple in the river, but the flow, the river will still flow. You know, the time, the events will still occur.
I mean, yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because again, I haven't seen the movie, but I know the story of Oppenheimer and know a good bit about the book that was written about it. And the thing that like drove him to make the bomb, you know, the ultimate question everyone always has is like, did he regret that or whatever? And he always said no, he didn't, because his whole driving force was, we can't let the Nazis have this, you know, because what he didn't realize is, because what he thought was like, if we create this thing, then nobody will ever want to do anything like this again. And what he didn't realize is that it would create the arms race of the rest of, you know, the 20th century, that would change, you know, everything for us, right? But, and what I'm getting at with all that, Mike, is that there is some bit of inevitability to all of this, because no matter what you do, no matter how important you think that moment might be, then something else is going to come along to it. Like I'll give you a good, this is kind of a personal story, but I had an opportunity when I was finishing grad school to take or when I was finishing my undergrad rather, to take a job at about 300 miles away from where I was in school. And if I had gotten the job, I would have had to do like my last semester remote, all this kind of stuff, right? And ultimately decided against it, because I thought, I don't really know if I really want to do that right now, you know, whatever. But what I realized later is I would have met my wife 3 years before I actually met her, because
Whoa.
she was working in the town where I was going to go to work. And I would have met her because I would have gone to the church she was working at, because it would have been the only place where I knew anybody in town. And like, I laugh about that and think
That's
sometimes, like,
crazy.
woo, you know, right? Yeah. I mean, yeah,
You've
isn't it
entered the Twilight
crazy?
Zone.
Right. Yeah. It kind of feels like, but I say that, and I'm like, but I'm also not hinging on the 455 other decisions that I made that led me to ultimately, you know, be in the area where we met. So it's fun to try to tie everything to one little piece, but what this movie preaches anything to you is that no, there are lots of cogs that have to turn, and yes, yours is important, but so is Jose's, so is Rayleigh's, so is everybody else's, so is Jeffrey's. Everybody's matters, you know, somewhere or another. So don't get too caught up in your own like hype of your own thing, because what's going to happen is going to happen. And I think that's what Gilliam is trying to tell here in this story, well, at least what he took from the story as it was that you can try to beat all of it. And while you're not an automaton, things that are going to work out are going to work out whether you do it or not, you know? And I don't know there, again, I feel like that's such a thing about the '90s, right? It just feels like that's such a '90s outlook on life. And I resonated with that.
Yeah. And so, you know, I think this is where the movie ends. However, the movie actually ends on our final glimpse on the airplane, which I guess this, I don't know if this is just like a pre 9/11 like thing in the movies, but like, you know, Dr. Peters, who, you know, stole the virus and gets on the plane, you know, he sits down and where I'm going with the pre 9/11 is like, there's shots fired in an airport. Today, no plane is taking off for the rest of that day, at the very least, if not the next 2 days. And, but, you know, Peters goes into the plane and he's like kind of looking relieved that he's like, oh, I'm actually going to get away with it. And he turns and we have one of the scientists from the future. And I believe he says something along the lines of like, oh, you know, what are you traveling for? And she says, oh, I'm here for insurance.
Yeah.
Or something like that. And
yeah, her job is insurance. Like, it's like she knows too what her role in this is.
Yeah, insuring, which then that's an interesting, it's like, is she there to take a sample? Is she there to ensure that Peters gets off at the next, you know, as he's getting to where he needs to go? Because then I'm like, well, wouldn't she be infected? Because unless she's already inoculated to the virus, and this happens.
That's my theory, is they could have done so much more with that character if they had tied her in earlier to the fact that she's part of this cabal as well. If that's what they want us to believe, like that would, even if unwittingly, like that would have been much more interesting in my opinion.
But I do love that ambiguity, where, because I feel like on the face value, you're supposed to think on the first viewing, you're like, oh, like, the message got through. He didn't necessarily die in vain. He completed his mission. However, when you on repeated watching and you start thinking about the subtext of what's going on, and even like the, you know, Gilliam's filmography and his stance on authoritarians, and like big government and, you know, big corporate people, you know, it's like, well, was she sent back? Was she there all along? Like, and I think that's the fun. It's like, you know, talking about those theories, because at the end of the day, we're never really gonna know. But and they're all equally valid, you know. It could be all the above, it could be one, but I like to think it's all of the above. So but what do you think about this ending? Do you think it's satisfying?
I mean, anytime a movie like this, if it wraps up too cleanly, then it's missed its point. A good time travel movie leaves you with that wondering thought of like, what if, and where could it go next? And what, oh, wow. You know, you let your mind just extrapolate, you know? I think of the first two Terminator movies, they both end with, you know, the first one ends on this note of like, she knows what's coming and it's a storm and it's this bleakness. And the next one ends with this light on a dark highway. Like, I'm going somewhere where the first time in my adult life, I don't know what happens next, you know? And if there's nothing else after that, you just think like, what could be? Or, you know, you think about the end of like Ripley at the end of Alien and Aliens, you know, she ends both those movies in the same place. She's in hypersleep, far, far away from home. And you think, what's next, you know? And I think a lot of times what actually comes next in a cinematic universe is never as satisfying as what you can dream up on your own.
Yep.
And that's why I like this movie and the fact that it never got sequelized. And I mean, I don't know where the television show went with it, but I can't imagine it followed the same path because it lasted for a little while. So I don't know. I think that's more fun, because if you're going to actively engage your audience in something like this, then you should leave them walking out of the theater actively engaging with the movie still. And if they are, then you've done your job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Awesome. So I think that kind of concludes the topic of 12 Monkeys this week. So we can end on our closing thoughts and final recommendations. So I can start on this one. So this is definitely I think this is a good introduction to Gilliam. Like, that's like truly Gilliam. That is his voice, his vision, or you know, his quote unquote his vision, as opposed to, you know, like Monty Python. You know, this feels a, it's not as, it's like visually stimulating, but it's not like overstimulating.
Yeah.
And it's very clear in what it's trying to say, you know, on a first watching. And then, you know, you can go back and, you know, there's a little bit of ambiguity mixed in, but it's pretty straightforward. I feel like the like average moviegoer can watch this and have a clear understanding of what he's going for. We have strong performances by, I mean, definitely Brad Pitt and Bruce Willis. I think it's an entertaining time travel movie that it's mostly just using it as a narrative device, not about the time travel. It's about, you know, these themes that we've been talking about. Yeah, and at the end of the day, I do highly recommend this film. Like I said, this would be the introduction film for Terry Gilliam. So, out of 10, I would give this a 7 out of 10. And on my Letterboxd, which, you know, you all can follow me if you want to see what I've been watching lately. It's, I just believe it's Amateur Auteurs. I gave this a 3 out of 5 stars. So I do solid recommendation, and I'm glad that I could be here for your first time watching it, Jay. So what about you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I echo a lot of what you said there, and will just say again that this is the kind of movie that begs you to watch it and then have other people around to talk about it, right? Like to, you want to try to have a conversation about this. Because when I watched this and then I had to go back and watch it again, I was like, oh man, I'm looking forward to doing this show, but much as any of the ones we've done, because this is a movie that just deserves to be talked about. And I applaud it for that. And as someone who's not a huge fan of Gilliam or his stuff, I do feel like it's probably his most complete piece. And it's definitely a good intro to that. And I think it's also something to show people to go like, if you only know Bruce Willis as the action star, or as the, as he became later in his life, the geezer teaser action star, if you, that's all you know about him, or the diehard guy, you miss some of the cool, subtle performances the guy could give. And I always tell people like, you should watch Pulp Fiction because he's a very different character in that, even though he's playing kind of a tough guy still, but he's got a different thing going on, and you should watch this. And now having seen it, I will definitely put it in there. So yeah, I'm with you. This is definitely 7 out of 10. I think my Letterboxd said it was a 3.5 back in the day when I first watched it. To do podcast research is what I called in the comments. Now, so I'll go back and add the link when the show's out. But yeah, I'm glad I got this, and it's definitely one that I'll want to rewatch and rewatch with some more folks too to get along with. So, but I'm glad we got to do it here. We got to break a couple of Gilliams off, and we're into the 2000s next.
Yeah.
And you have convinced me to go back to a director I broke up with
Yeah.
next. I
And
broke up with,
early in the relationship, you broke up with him.
yeah, I broke up with Quentin Tarantino pretty early, and haven't gone back to his stuff since Jackie Brown. And
Yeah.
I've seen pieces of the Kill Bills, and beyond that, I've just stayed away. But you've convinced me to watch Inglourious Basterds, and a podcast friend Nick, that I've done many shows with through the years, heard me say, I told him I was like, I'm gonna do this with you. He's like, finally somebody convinces you to watch that. He's been after me to do it since it came out. And so I said, well, yeah, I'll finally get to check that one off the list. It's at the tail end of the 2000s. It's
Yeah,
super early,
we
but
just got in there.
Truth was, I said I spent all those years doing music and stuff like that. Well, in the 2000s, I caught up. I just started watching. I watched all kinds of movies for a decade there. So I don't think there was a lot I hadn't seen so many times I couldn't call it first. But yeah, I broke up with QT. So I said, well, okay, we'll go back and we'll talk with him again and see if he's got anything worthwhile to do. But it's going to take a lot to convince me, man, because I really walked away from him for, well, I'll get into it when we get into that
Yeah,
show.
because
But yeah.
that's I feel like it's gonna be a 45-minute discussion about why you broke up with Quentin,
Yeah.
and then it's gonna be like an hour and a half discussion about Inglourious Basterds, because I do love the movie, but we'll save that for the next episode that we get together. So, but Jay, always it's always a pleasure. Thanks again for coming on. Why don't you plug
Absolutely.
where we can find you, any of your shows you got going on?
Yeah. A Film Strip Podcast. We're still out there going strong. Just go to filmstrippodcast.com. That'll take you to all of our distribution sites. We're pretty much everywhere a podcast can be found. And we're on the different social medias at Film Strip Pod in some form or another, but you can, keep up. It's mostly Ron that puts out the stuff, but every now and then Lindsay and I will throw something out. But we're recording a lot of shows, and We are getting ready for a big Shocktober lineup. We've got a lot of guests coming on and having a real good time with those this year, and then planning some cool stuff toward the end of the year, and then getting ready for next year as well. So yeah, Filmstrip Podcast, we've been around for 13 plus years now, and you know, no reason to quit now. So we'll just keep going and putting stuff out as long as people are listening. So
yeah,
appreciate you having me on, and always good talking movies with you, Mike.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure. And you know, you mentioned that Filmstrip's been around for 13 years. I've been listening to Filmstrip for 10 years, you know, just over. So that's crazy. So it's always, I always get, you know, like, it's always amazing that I'm like, I remember just like listening to that Stephen King retrospective and being like, yeah, I really dig this guy. And now here we are 10 years later, regularly talking about movies. So it's always a pleasure, man. Yeah, we'll link all that in the show descriptions. And everyone, thank you for listening to this episode of Amateur Auteurs. You can follow us on Twitter at AuteursPod, and you can email us with any questions, comments, or concerns at theamateurauteurspodcast@gmail.com. And as always, everyone, we'll see you next time. Thank you.